Indo-European languages, but strikingly capable of describing the dynamic world of quantum physics. He eventually suffered the fate of one who was ahead of his time, and so the slings and arrows of others who put great effort but little actual understanding into trying to discredit him. And Benjamin Whorf was one of those people. David Bohm, we talk about to the rescue of Benjamin Whorf, was one of the most brilliant physicists of the 20th century and a colleague of Albert Einstein and Krishnamurti. Krishnamurti, I guess that says, upset the scientific apple cart when he moved beyond a theory of relativity and quantum physics to define a whole new paradigm of physics and consciousness, one that bolstered the theories of Whorf and mirrored the Hopi worldview. And again, if you think about back to the beginning, it was near the end of his life when Bohm was able to complete the circle between modern physics and ancient knowledge. And he died in 1992 after attending the first ever meeting between linguists, Western physicists, and Native American scholars and elders at the Fetzer Institute. And that conference, it was apparently for the first time that Native America and modern science had a lot more in common than anyone ever dreamed of. And the meeting spawned a series of dialogues now dubbed in this DVD, The Language of Spirit, The Language of Spirituality, and to continue to this day exploring the convergence of modern physics, reality, language, and Native America. Now, you can get that whole story that I'm trying to piece together here for you so that you can understand it, that we are fortunate enough to have in this DVD called The Language of Spirituality, that we are offering it to you out there in New Jersey and New York and Connecticut and over the internet. And those of you who are in the internet online, give to WBA.org to give your $100, $200, $300, $1,000 to keep us going. Make this a good day for First Voices Indigenous Radio. Make this a good day for WBAI. Make this radio, because you can hear the very most exciting shows, because it gets to your sensories and it makes it sensational. And they're talking about war and they're talking about peace and, you know, boredom. And, you know, they're talking about health, which can be boring, because if you're taking all these health things and you're not getting well, there's something else underneath all of that, you know. And I think that we have to understand that the spirit, the mystery, the energy, the sacredness of who we are as beings has a lot to do with that, rather than the outer layers of, you know, my body is healthy, therefore my spirit must be healthy. That's not true, because it starts with the seed in the thought process, and that thought process we've been taken away from. We've been given a language that has reached its limits in 1910. So, you know, this is what we've been regurgitating for over 100 years now, 103 years. So now let's think about this other language, these other languages. It doesn't mean that you can go out there and be learn the Hopi language. You can. You can go learn the Lakota language, but you have to understand it in a different way. We are often trying to take that language and put it in, you know, as an appendage of our own language and understanding. Well, it won't fit, but that language will encompass English and be able to understand, okay, now we're looking at the object as a chair rather than chairing, because I can do it. I can see that as a chair in English, but yet see it as chairing and know it's always in motion. So that's the language right now. The participants, Dan Moon Hawk Alford, who is a PhD professor of linguistics at the California Institute of Integral Studies and of originator of quantum physics, quantum linguistics, let's say it that way. Lira Littlebear, who is also, I guess he's a JD now with the Blood Tribe of the Blackfoot Confederacy and former director of the American Indian Program at Harvard University and professor emeritus of Native Studies at the University of Lethbridge. And David Pete, who was born in Liverpool and earned a PhD at Liverpool University, has been moving to and moved to Canada to get this process moving and along. Part of this DVD also, Fred Allen Wolf, who is a physicist, writer, and lecturer in theoretical physics at UCLA, and continues to write and lecture throughout the world and conduct research on the relationship of quantum physics to consciousness. Also, a physicist, Stefan Gamboa Eastman, who posits that one of the deepest cultural myths of Western civilization since the time of Aristotle has been that the nature of science is logical and therefore has a special claim to our respect and acceptance. And he goes into the logics of spirituality, the logics of science, and tries to originate in logic as well as present itself in final logical form. And how we do that? Well, you know, you only can get this DVD to show how he's beginning to find his so-called theoretical science of the 19th and 20th centuries, and by discoveries made in states of consciousness and things like dreams and even fever and ritual context. So we have that with the DVD. We also have Matthew Bronson, who is an educational linguist and works as a professor in a social cultural anthropology program in California Institute of Studies, Integral Studies. So you have many of these so-called experts here in this DVD, and we are asking you now to step up to that phone, to sit down and dial that number or punch in the number, as they say. The dialing is sort of an old-school way, dialing, you know, as a rotary, go around and around. So, you know, punch the numbers in. And the number would be 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602. For those.
Okay, and this program that they have had broadcasting in place of Robert Knight's show seems to run another half hour, but I'm going by the grid. I'm going by the schedule that we were given. And that schedule says, oh, in fact, I'm looking at it right now. Let me make sure that I'm on proper, because I haven't, yes, that schedule says 1:30, Hour of the Wolf, host Jim Freund. And that is almost exactly what we are about to do. Okay, did I sigh? Okay, let me refrain from using the, yes, I did. Put it in place. So I think it's time.
WBAI is changing.
Okay, no. He's still talking and he's on the computer. I have to silence him. There. That doesn't mean that you have the right to stop pledging. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't be calling 516-620-3602. That's right. There it is. It's not smudged over there. It's a transmitter fund, they say. Well, that's out of date, but what? It's not out of date. Transmitter is still $50,000 a month. But 516-620-3602 is the number to call. But in the meantime, yes, it is indeed time for, in fact, past due for Hour of the Wolf. and good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, our guest is James Ryan. Well, you'll be hearing more. Stay tuned. Once again, good morning. So, what can I say? WBAI continues to go through changes. It is a matter of public record, at least since the Daily News reported that we are looking for somebody to lease the management, not exactly lease the signal, but lease the management. Now, this could be a terrible thing, and this could be a wonderful thing. You know, this is not necessarily doom if the right people take it. So I just wanted to say that. One way or the other, we have a lot of operating costs. When we laid off two-thirds of our staff several months ago, we still have to give them their severance. That's a mere $200,000. We have to pay every month for the Empire State Building. Every month, that's $50,000. We have to pay rent here at City College, which is very low. All these things being relative, very low meaning about, $5,000 or $6,000. We're paying storage and all the equipment. We had 120 Wall Street. I don't know how much that is. It's not free. And we're paying rent on our studios to be, assuming that we survive to get there. That's another, $6,000 or $7,000. Something like that, which is not expensive. It's the whole floor of a building. It's got a performance space. I love that space. It is so neat on 388 Atlantic Avenue. So, and in fact, I'm going to try to talk the station manager into letting me do something there on Halloween. That would be really cool because it's got this performance space. Brecht Forum is moving in to that space as well. They are a very cool group, and if it's good enough for them, it's darned well good enough for us. I remember when we used to do weekly, actually twice a week, concerts WBAI, the once upon a time famed WBAI free music store. And Peter Schickele did two such concerts for me. You just heard his music. His music as Peter Schickele, not as well known as his music as Professor Peter Schickele. And of course, he is not the composer of the music of P.D.Q. Bach. He merely had the misfortune to foist it on us. Well, that's the deal. That's the deal if one is an aficionado. And I do enjoy I like comedy, classical music, and its derivatives. One of the biggest thrills ever was going to a P.D.Q. Bach concert, and he often had a pre-concert event. And one time at 8 o'clock, when one expects Shigley to make an entrance somehow, curtain opens up and Anna Russell walked out. Now, for those who don't know Anna Russell, tune out and find a record and listen to it. Anna Russell was brilliant. Her ring cycle analysis is one of the... I'm not even turning off the mic. Pardon, I'm just sneezing at all of this. Pardon me.
That's quite all right.
It's
one of those weird evenings.
Really is. Tomorrow is the full moon.
I think you might be right. I know...
Oh, I know I'm right. Well, I know my full moons when I start howling, and they this is Hour of the Wolf here.
That's true.
Yeah, no, I just happened to notice that tomorrow night that's Friday night. This is, for many people, this is Wednesday night. But, you know, we're on the cusp, Wednesday night, Thursday morning.
Yeah, that's true, although last I observed it was waxing towards fall at about the three-quarter point.
Yeah.
So.
But that would have been like a week ago.
No, that was last night, actually.
Oh, was it? Really? Yeah. Okay, yeah. But tomorrow's the full moon, okay. At least according to my calendar.
Yeah.
Which is a phone, so who the heck knows?
Well, the Naval Observatory is open again right now, so we can check with them a little later.
Oh, which was that? There's a queue. Oh, the Naval Observatory. They have opened that.
I believe they should.
Okay, they should have. It should have never closed.
There is that, too, yes.
You know, they kept NOAA open, the weather service.
Mm.
That was never closed. It's too essential. You know, ships and planes and Mr. Weatherby all depend.
Yeah, and then, of course, you had the other things, like where the CDC, where everybody said, nobody here but us sick chickens.
Yeah, exactly. But... no, the Naval Observatory is open. I was thinking, ever since we moved here to CUNY, I'm a CUNY fan. One of my favorite TV channels in New York is in Brooklyn. It used to be on UHF, so I assume most places Channel 75 is the CUNY channel.
Right.
I broadcast one of my favorite shows, Classic Arts Showcase,
where
you can see Anna Russell a lot. Do you know the show, Jim?
Familiar with it. I don't always go into that neighborhood.
Yeah, it's on like three times a day for an hour. Okay. And then on weekend, and they have one new episode every day. It's a satellite channel is what it is. And they have paid for by Adolph's Meat Tenderizer. It's paid for by two people, both of whom have passed away, one of whom made his fortune with Adolph's Meat Tenderizer. It's not sponsored by anybody. They don't mention that. It's just, okay. When I read his obit, I found out where his money came from. And where his money went to, along with another philanthropist, was to create this show. And they funded the show for something like 30 years.
And they say there's no red meat in public television.
Yeah, right. So this is an hour a day available to all non-commercial TV stations. You can take it or not. And it's just clips from old movies, classical music, ballet.
So sort of an upmarket version of Night Flight.
That's exactly what it is. That's exactly what it is. Night Flight without the need to light up first. For those few people out there who may remember, I loved Night Flight. That was a great show.
Yeah, I got introduced to a lot of great pieces of animation. I still remember Grinning Evil Death, which was the first CG piece that MIT Labs had done.
Ooh. Well, was that Ed Catmull?
God, it's been a while.
Yeah.
It was the one with Captain Sarcastic trying to save trying to save the city of Boston from a large metal cockroach that had descended a la the Martian walking.
I don't remember that.
It's around somewhere.
I remember the very, very early Pixar attempts, which I know are Ed Catmull and whoever was working with him. And, of course, there was stuff that was inspired by, and Ed Catmull used to work with Ed Emshwiller, who, of course, is husband to the science fiction writer Carol Emshwiller, and who's read for us. And who's now 93 years old. And I have a painting of her that I have to get to her, damn it. I've had it for like 2 or 3 years now. And I shouldn't have had it at all, but it was just safer for me to bring home.
Okay.
We did her 90th birthday party at a reading. You know, and so, and I had this painting of her done by her husband. And her husband, aside from being one of the first avant-garde video filmmakers and animators using computer graphics, and we're talking about CG in 1974, so he's really one of the pioneers. And he worked with Ed Catmull, whose name is still on all Pixar films today.
Right.
And she, Carol, was a model. If you were to see some of the drawings that Ed Emshwiller did for the major pulp magazines in the late 40s and the Digest in the early 50s, and you saw a bug-eyed monster slavering over a woman holding a ray gun, that woman was probably Carol.
Oh.
And she's still around. She's great. So.
With any luck, someday I'll have the honor to meet her.
Oh, you haven't met her.
No,
we'll have to fix that.
Yeah.
We'll have to fix that. I have to get her back. She needs escorting because she has eye problems today. She was at the Science Fiction Writers of America bash last week. On Monday night last week. But I wouldn't know if you were there because I was sort of in a daze. There were all these people there who said, "Where's Jim?" And I said, "Where's them?" And, you know, we caught up an email later on saying, "Were you there?" "Yeah, I was there. Where were you?" Couldn't hear a thing. It's a lovely space, Manhattan penthouse, but it has glass that lets you see all of New York. From what is, I guess, about the 20th floor near Union Square, and tall ceilings, so you cannot hear a thing.
So, in other words, all those old movies where you have Cole Porter at the piano and you have the New York skyline, that's one of those Hollywood fantasies, because Cole Porter was playing there, nobody would be able to know.
It's just one of those things. One of those fabulous... Never mind.
Well, better you than me. I think you've got a better register than I do.
Maybe so. But register of trivia, anyway. Although, knowing Cole Porter lyrics, there's nothing trivial about that. That's important. You know, when you go to school and they try to teach geography and all that stuff, heck! Teach Gershwin and Porter and Christine Lavin and Peter Schickele and Steel Icepan.
And a few others we can throw in there.
Oh, yeah, lots of others.
David Van Tiegum, I think, certainly.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, speaking of people with eclectic tastes, I do have to give out that phone number a few more times because...
Sure.
Render
unto Caesar what belongeth unto Caesar.
Indeed. Yes. And they're going to seize us if we don't pay bills.
Veni, vici, pecuniae.
And we're at about that point. You know, people, I don't think they realize the seriousness of this. Our program director has been sort of like, I don't know if he's been yanked exactly back to California, but he was going to be instituting changes, and all of a sudden, no changes are going to happen. I'm going to California. I'll be back in a few days. It'll be very interesting to see what happens. But officially, Pacifica has released this LMA, this leased management agreement. Excuse me, when I say release this, it means they have a call for it. They have a, they're looking for proposals, which must be put in by...
They put out the two let sign.
Yeah, basically.
Oh, dear.
But the two let sign could be for other people to manage who's already here. There's, you know, they might decide to get rid of every last person. They might decide to keep every last person. Mm-hmm. It must be a nonprofit.
Right.
And there must be Pacifica people involved in the running of the station. It must be owned by Pacifica. So it will be leased, but owned by Pacifica, and it must have somebody who makes sure that the Pacifica mission is maintained, and
this is the mission that requires that they be open so that when the swallows return, they actually can land.
That's, yeah, pretty much it, except that's during our Spanish programming.
Ah, sí, bueno.
Indeed, indeed. So that's what, you know, and I'm not telling any listeners anything that wasn't in the Daily News, and you know it's true if you read it in the Daily News. At any rate, the telephone number to call and pledge your support, our lifeline, is area code 516-620-3602. Now, how much should you pledge? I will tell you. $10 a month. That's $120 a year. That makes you a sustaining member of WBAI. But when you get down to $10 a month, it's the same price as, oh, say, subscribing to the Warner Brothers Archive on a Roku box, right? That's what it costs, $10 a month. And for that, you support what we're already giving you for free, WBAI. Or for free when we're not begging for money, which is something that whoever we will be by, you know, our next cycle, or whoever will be us by the next cycle, we have to get away from just begging on the air for money, because we do it so much that nobody listens, and if nobody's listening and you beg on the air, nobody's going to pay for it. We need to get out of that cycle. And one of the things is $10 a month makes you a BAI buddy. Want to be my buddy? BAI, the bargain BAI buddy, both. Okay, why are we referring to both? You get a thumb, you get an 8 gigabyte thumb drive, which has something called the 100 speaker collection. It's a lot of speeches and things, plus a best of WBAI. This is stuff put together by Peter Beauchamp, who knows how to edit. He knows his segues. He knows how to make something sound entertaining. And it's a thumb drive. It's actually useful. You get 8 whole gigs. If you were to go into Staples, my God, you'd have to pay $20 for this. And we're only asking $120. But we're doing it in a small way. It's $10 a month. Or if you like, more. And the way you do it is by making a phone call. I'll give you that phone number a few times, and then we will talk to our guest. Who's being very patient with us. 516-620-3602 is the number to call. We used to say in New York City, call in anywhere in the world. I keep pushing this option because I know that we get phone, I've gotten calls from Bulgaria. Mm-hmm. We actually have a regular listener in Bulgaria.
Really?
Who uses Skype to call in. And we have phone calls all from all over the place. I've had guests in Australia. Easy for them. It's the afternoon. So there are probably listeners in Australia or New Zealand who are, you know, I guess it would be mid-morning or something like that right now. So
good day, mate.
Yeah, good day. So, well, our program director, or the person who... And it still entitles our program directors for Melbourne.
Ah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Andrew Phillips used to do a show here called Investigations, and I used to do my best announcing work. I used to say, something in my throat.
Probably
I used to say,
at this point,
this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. Stay tuned now for Investigations. And he would come in and scream. And this is our program director now. So, only person in all these years ever to suspend me. In all these years I've been here, that's since 1967. He's the only one to suspend me, and I think I got off light. But I'm not going to tell that story on the air again. Just suffice it to say, if you put the news on at double speed, you'd get suspended as well. But if I, there was on the news, I'd do it again. Damn it. Anyway. Now we don't have a news department anymore. That's sad. Area code 516-620-3602. Skype it in, call it in, Google Voice it in. Do whatever you want, however you want, but call it in, please.
Warn you that because it's cloudy, smoke signals may not work so well.
That's right. Yeah, but you know, actually, there are people there. It's a call center. Next time we pitch, which won't be until, probably next month. No, it should probably be January. The next time we pitch, we're going to be giving you the old phone number. In fact, the old phone number actually works to call in here.
Oh.
212-209-2900, 212-209-2900, but that only works for on the air. The pledge line is a different number. I think regular listeners already know it, but that's not the number for the morning. The number for the morning is 516-620-3602. Okay, we've burned almost half an hour, and I'm terribly sorry, Jim. Good morning.
Oh, good morning, Jim.
How are you?
Very good. It's interesting getting back to this time. There was a period in my career when I used to do a lot of my writing during this period. Especially, I liked this period because it was very isolating and it allowed you to just explore elements that you wouldn't otherwise have seen, especially as I was doing a lot more darker genre material, a lot of horror, stuff involving horrible creatures, the collapse of civilization, stuff like that.
Have you ever seen the movie Hour of the Wolf, after which this radio show is named? Ingmar Bergman directed.
Okay, I think I've just lost a couple of cool points by admitting no.
Okay, no. It's not a better Bergman film. Although I will say a bad Bergman film is better than most people's best films.
That's true.
But it's a weak movie. It stars Max von... It's the usual cast of that era. It's Max von Sydow and Liv Ullmann and a few other people who have smaller roles. But it's actually a horror movie.
Oh.
It's Bergman's horror film. There's a vampire. There's a werewolf. There's manifestations of the mind of a painter, and it all takes place during the Varg Teemin, which is the Hour of the Wolf.
Ah.
The wolf time.
Yes. Wow.
And so that's how the movie is translated into English. It's Hour of the Wolf, but it's properly Varg Teemin.
Varg Teemin.
Yeah.
Okay. I probably should have used that at some point earlier when somebody said, so when are you getting a chance to write? I'd said Varg Teemin, and they said, "Oh, wow, he's mysterious and interesting."
So, exactly. Some people would have known that. Some people don't know what the heck Hour of the Wolf is, like a TV show called Babylon 5 had an episode called Hour of the Wolf. And it was a good episode, too.
Oh, was it one of J. Michael Straczynski's?
Yeah, it was one of Straczynski's. Yeah.
Whatever happened to him?
I saw his name on stuff. But, yeah,
I meant in terms of comparing what he did on Bab 5 versus One More Day. I mean, really.
Actually, I haven't seen one of his movies, not even Changeling, which I would usually have seen just on the grounds that it was directed by old Squint, Clint Eastwood.
Actually, when he went into comics, I mean, he was doing stuff in that, and it almost convinced me that if you were doing, if you wanted to break into comics, the first thing you had to have was WGA card, because you had all of these people who were suddenly doing the writing for it, and it was a little disturbing that the normal channels that had been there were suddenly shifted elsewhere.
Well, so he got his WGA card partly thanks to Pacifica Radio and our LA station KPFK, when Mike Hodel, who was an occasional co-host in Hour of the Wolf, and Margot Adler was the host Monday through Friday. I was the Thursday and Friday co-host. And Hodel was a former news director here, and he was on a few Mondays. And then he went to the West Coast, and he created a science fiction, where he became news director at our LA station.
Ah.
And he created a science fiction show there called Hour 25.
Okay.
And then for absolutely no good reason, at a very young, tender age, 40-something, he just dropped dead.
Oh, dear.
And one of his guests, a fellow by the name Harlan something, more or less took the show over and brought in, on a regular basis, Joe Straczynski, a.k.a. J. Michael Straczynski, and used that as a platform to pitch, in L.A., of course, what eventually became Babylon 5. I'm not saying it would have happened without that, but it helped.
Ah.
And Joe Straczynski had an episode of Babylon 5 called Hour of the Wolf.
Right.
In which the character Ivana explains that Hour of the Wolf is at about 3 a.m. when thoughts are whatever. Wrong. Just wrong. Hour of the Wolf, Bergman didn't make it up either. It's a real myth from Sweden and Scandinavia in general about the wolf time, and they referred to twilight, the morning twilight. And may I point out, the morning twilight, when you get that far north, can be 3 hours long, as the opening to A Little Night Music for those who are Sondheim fans.
And depending upon what time of the year, you probably have breakfast before it happens.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. Very possibly. So the Varg Teeman actually is a long period of time. In New York City, it lasts about half an hour, and it's usually somewhere between 5 and 7 a.m., which was the time slot that Margot had and that I had until almost exactly 3 years ago.
Ah.
So.
Yeah, that's very interesting, yes.
So that's Hour of the Wolf. That's the history. James Morrison, Jim Morrison.
Right.
James Morrison wrote a poem called Hour of the Wolf.
Yeah.
But he never set it to music. He didn't live long enough. So maybe we shouldn't. Well, he died with a needle in his arm, so.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, there is that to worry about. It's interesting, all the talk about history. As part of my training, I guess, or just inclination in that, was always a fascination with history. One of my undergrad degrees was actually in the study of history. I'd gotten a degree in, along with an English degree, at University of Buffalo.
SUNY?
Yes, SUNY Buffalo. And a lot of when I moved forward, I was using a lot of historical elements towards that. And as I proceeded along, ultimately the first book I shared online was a historical novel called Raging Gale, which was about a pirate crew that kidnaps a woman. And the woman who is kidnapped, Hope Harvey, falls under the sway of the captain, one Abigail Sanders, who is modeled after a number of women who became famous as pirates in their own right. And this, of course, it was actually a very liberating experience to be able to take a lot of what I did in history and experiment with new form, especially syndication via the web, for providing the work. It was so I've always been sort of tied to history and trying to trying to pull into the past and pull parallels and see what we can do about using that mirror to better understand us and what we're going through.
Yeah. Now, when you say shared online, you didn't mention who the author was.
Oh, you mean my book?
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly.
Let me clarify that.
Yes, thank you.
When I say shared, I mean...
Somebody needs to blow your horn.
Well, yeah, although usually it sounds more like something blowing out of... Yes. Raging Gale was the first novel I had written and have shared to a general audience, which means that right now the version that's in is available for free. Is available for free at ragingale.wordpress.com. The complete novel has been up for a little bit. I am looking though to see about an edition that would be committed for paper or Kindle, where because the original was written with a lot of cliffhangers, I may be shaving off a bunch of cliffs in order to make it a little bit more manageable at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And how long have you been publishing fiction? And let's get, I'd like to talk a bit about the whole concept of self-publishing and all that.
Well,
that was 10 years ago, criteria for me would be if somebody was self-published, then they weren't good enough for Hour of the Wolf. But that's no longer true because there's a lot of really good stuff that that people can find online and even printed.
Well, I think part of that is because the whole environment has changed. When I was a lot younger, the idea that you didn't need to self-publish because you had all these wonderful markets that would certainly be willing to take a chance with you. And a lot of them have started to fall away because of the economics that are involved.
Yeah.
A lot of magazines that would have been there are definitely no longer doing so, and the ones that are still bothering are being a lot more selective.
Yeah, the selectivity is true, but there is also a lot more independent press.
True.
Coming in play, which is magazines that, you know, we now have Clark's World and Cross Genres and Lightspeed Magazine and places. These are markets that did not exist viably a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing well.
Yes.
Sometimes thanks to Kickstarter.
Well, unfortunately, but you have to remember in the beginning it was a great idea. You could pull the audience directly and say, sure, we could do that. And then the abuse started to pop into the system, which I think is true.
Of everything.
Yes.
Yeah, of everything. I mean, Crossed Genres does a lot of fine anthologies through Kickstarter. And they fund their magazine. It's a pretty good magazine that they put out. In fact, they had folded the magazine, and then Kickstarter came into being. And I do believe the editors, Bart Lieb and Kay Holt, might correct me or not, that when Kickstarter, that they were able to relaunch the magazine thanks to Kickstarter, and had it not been there, they would be looking at totally different forms of monetization, if not simply trying to pay for their house some other way. Mm-hmm. And they both have other jobs, but they're currently putting together the anthology The Long Hidden, being edited by Rose Fox and Daniel Jose Older,
okay,
who's been both a Nursef reader and a performer here on Hour of the Wolf. And, yeah, these are good books. So Kickstarter has made those viable. And I may look to it for the New York Review of Science Fiction reading series because I pay for that out of pocket.
Mm.
We ask for donations at the door.
Oh, yes.
Oh, which reminds me.
Okay.
I should mention the next reading. I'll just mention it. November 5th, And normally it's free admission, but not that day because it's Guy Fawkes Day. So we need a penny for the guy. At minimum, one penny admission, a penny for the guy. Normally we suggest $7. It's free admission. Right. No, we turn nobody away. But that day, I think everybody ought, not must, ought to give a penny for the guy. If you're going to give $7, give $7.01. We'll give you the penny on your way in so that you can donate it. But you have to give a penny for the guy.
Remember, the 5th of November.
Indeed. Yes. And on the 5th of November, Amy Goldschlager will curate. Mm-hmm. And the readers will be Rajan Khanna and Fran Wild, both of whom have sold novels within the last couple of months.
Oh.
And both they're both established short story writers.
All right.
But now they've sold novels. And so these will be newbie novels for November. Oh. Nifty newbie novels for
Nifty
November.
Newbie novels November. I'll try and do that five times fast.
Okay, so November, remember 5th of November. And more information, go to ourwolf.com or look it up on Facebook.
I never understood that, unfortunately. Some gentleman tries to blow up the Houses of Parliament, and you put
and become celebrated.
Yeah, I mean, what's next? 100 years from now, we're going to do Spear Day, where we fly a plane over Scotland and push a dummy out of it.
Something like that. But on the other hand, we have Halloween.
True.
All Hallows Eve. Now that comes from a good place. Of essentially, you know, there was a pagan holiday,
right?
Which actually, All Hallows Eve was one, but there should have been one for the fall harvest because they're usually agriculturally based.
Mm.
And I'm sorry, Margot, I'm forgetting. When I talk to you tomorrow.
Samhain?
Samhain.
Samhain.
Yes,
thank
it's
you.
Spelled Samhain, but it's pronounced Samhain. It's Celtic or Gaelic or something, so the letters don't matter. It's Samhain.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, yes, that's the. Right. Thank you. It's Samhain.
Samhain.
And.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the old joke right there. Why do the Celts have such a rich oral tradition? Because none of them can spell.
There is that. So anyhow, you were talking. We'd gotten past the pirates.
Yes.
What else? Now, let me tell the story, speaking of the reading series, of how I first really became cognizant of you, was we were doing, it's all thanks to Keith DeCandido.
Okay.
We had a reading with Aaron Rosenberg and Keith DeCandido, and in the middle of intermission, when we're waiting for Keith, who should have been there before the thing opened, calls up to talk about car trouble. And I went to the audience, and I was thinking, okay, I see we've got Rick Bowes in the audience, and Barbara Krasnoff, and Terrence Taylor, so I know we've got people who probably, at the flick of an iPad, could read something. And bingo, there you were, out of the audience. And I thought, okay, this is open mic night.
Mm.
And boy, was it good.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
So is your reading, by the way, which people will hear shortly, if I can shut up.
No. That's quite all right. I mean, you're the professional.
I've been doing it 43 years, yeah, but I'll be professional when I'm paid, which at WBAI will be a cold Samhain in August.
All right. Fair enough. Fair enough.
I think I'm professional, it were. But no, it was a fine, fine reading. I have a lot of problems with a lot of writers who don't know how to read.
Hmm.
I shouldn't say problems. I like the writer's voice. Other people like to be narrators. And they do. And in fact, in the podcast that I edit professionally, I edit professional narrators,
mm-hmm.
Very professional. I mean, people that do audiobooks left and right and all kinds of stuff. So
okay.
That's who I'm editing. And apparently, I don't know if I can announce this yet, but it's been sort of, the cat was out of the bag, not by me, but apparently I will be hosting that podcast soon.
Oh, mazel tov.
So, and then at that point I will be professional because I am paid for that work. So,
oh, that's great. That's great.
Yeah, and it's a good podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
At any rate, why?
Because we were talking about my...
Your reading.
Yes.
Yes, indeed.
And it's kind of like 42nd Street. You may be going out there as a youngster, but you'll be coming back a star.
Dorothy, yes. Sorry, just the image of B.B. Daniels.
Well...
hit my head. Although I've seen I saw the original Broadway show. I did not see the revival. I saw the Jerry Orbach, Gower Champion directed version, where Gower Champion made headlines by dying opening night. Everybody thought it was a gag from David Merrick.
I remembered seeing the footage of that. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a great show, though.
Yeah.
It was a great show. I, from what I saw, clips, I did not care for the revival. And thus, an enmity between Rick Bowes and I exists to this very day over which is the better version. We also fight over better versions of Sweeney Todd. We know what's worth fighting over. Forget this little, you know, stuff in Congress.
Or say, Bills fans versus just about anybody else out there.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm willing to admit the Buffalo Bills. I mean, if you're an Irish-based writer, you have a lost cause that you always go with. And mine, someday I'd like to see the Bills come back into the playoffs.
Well, you see, I've vaguely heard of the Bills, being a former baseball fan. So I'm more like Mets or the Cubbies or, you know, those are my losing teams. And formerly the Red Sox, except they haven't lost.
Yeah.
I mean, they've actually won games, so now I can't be as much of a Sox fan. So Mets, Cubbies, those are, you know, and there'll always be a place in my heart for the St. Louis Browns. The losingest team in the history of baseball, the St. Louis Browns.
Yeah.
Owned by Bill Veeck, as in Rick. Anyway, and I don't even follow, well, I don't know if you could call the Mets professional sports, but I don't follow professional sports anymore.
Hmm.
So
fair enough.
I saw one game this year, and it was just last week, because I was with some Yankee fans, and they were, they don't have a dog in the fight, but they were watching a playoff, and when it got to the 10th inning, we gave up and went home. And I have no idea to this day who won the game. The playoffs are still ongoing as far as I know.
I didn't get a chance to check the scores on the way in. I'll have to do that.
Yeah, L.A. against the Cardinals.
Yeah.
I think it was game one that we were watching.
All right.
Yeah. It was a good game.
Yeah.
Great pitching. But that's about it for me. Otherwise, I go to the Brooklyn Cyclones, which is about as unprofessional.
Well, I mean, you go to a team like the Cyclones or the Staten Island Yankees, not so much because, more so because you want to have the atmosphere of a ballpark, and doing it in those two places, it's affordable.
It's affordable, and it's a game.
Yeah, yeah.
It's still a game. It's not big business.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there is that personal touch that's there that you don't necessarily see on the. Although I got to admit, I did attend one Mets game this season, and I think because they knew that everything was just basically out of reach for them, there was this sort of, just think of us as like the biggest AAA team ever.
Yeah.
And it was
nice. And that's fine. Yeah. And that's fine. Yeah, that's why I'm a Mets fan, you know, because, or was a Mets fan. It was, I swore it all off after the second baseball strike.
Yeah, that would do.
I had tickets for. I was in Chicago. I had tickets to go see the Mets play the Cubs at Wrigley Field, and the second strike hit, and that was like, okay, this is just greed versus greed. on all sides of the divide here, and I gave up. So, the self-publishing question is an interesting question, because there are some people that do it. There's been a controversy recently, in fact, online about some editors that publish their own books and then buy their own stories for their own books. And there is a point when self-publishing is still just vanity press.
Yeah, I think there's still a little bit of that out there right now. I mean, there are definitely more options for people to do their own stuff and maintain a certain amount of integrity. I mean, I've done both. I have actually gone both professional and self-pub. Most of my professional has been more technical writing than that, particularly for particularly in Dragon and Pyramid, for which is a shout out to the role-playing game homies out there.
Right. But you had an editor.
Yeah.
Who chose your work, that chose you as the writer and oversaw what you were writing. And right there, to me, that's the mark of professional. Now, the next level down can be self-published without an editor. You didn't have an editor for the first book, right?
I did have editorial assistance with my lovely wife, Susan.
Yes.
Who was a great help on that.
So other eyes, and she's pretty professional.
Oh, she is wonderful.
So other eyes saw it.
Yes. And
by the way, for anybody out there listening, don't just write it and put it up.
No.
I've been a technical writer, you know, about computers, software, stuff like that. My partner is editor of a major computer magazine, and when she writes anything but her blog, she sends it to another editor to read it, and that editor sends their stuff to her, and so it goes. That's the way.
Speaking of wives and editing, I do need to bring this up, which will become apparent why in a little bit, and that about 10 years ago or so, she was editor of a magazine that was published online called Rooftop Sessions, which was a magazine that was devoted to fiction that used as its theme the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a number of ways to approach the Beatles as either thematic elements or characters. You had something that was a little bit just beyond, the glorious fangirl just wants to do something with that. And she brought a professionalism to it that I don't think has been seen since. And this is one of those magazines that they come, they go, we miss them.
If there is room for that, I would write a review today.
Okay.
Of a play I saw, I don't know, maybe 25 years ago by Larry Kerwin.
Oh, Liverpool Fantasy.
What a brilliant. Let me tell you, Beatles fan or not, this is great science fiction.
Yes.
This is the definitive work for theater, at the very least, of alternate history. The entire thing based on when Please Please Me came out. That was supposed to have been the B-side of the record. Mm. And a song from The Music Man, Till There Was You, was the A-side, because Paul had this lovely voice. So George Martin, no relation to
George R. R. Martin.
To Railroad Martin, yeah. George Martin, I believe it was the person who said, no, make Please Please Me the A-side. Well, in this universe, the Beatles put out Till There Was You on the A side of the record, and Please Please Me on the B side. And as a result, they had a career. But eventually, Paul goes to Las Vegas to become a popular singer, and mm-hmm. Ringo performs in any bar you can find. George becomes a priest, and John becomes...
On the Dole.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
A paperback writer on the Dole, with a son in a very skinhead-like kind of a world, which is what England is, because it never... The counterculture never became popularized because there was no... I mean, it's a great play.
It was also a good novel, too. He did turn it into a... he did turn it into a novel.
Later. I didn't know that.
Yeah, oh, yes, yes. Where some of the thematic elements were the Neo-Mosbyites. Do actually... It becomes a lot more apparent, especially when he goes into scenes describing what's happening on the streets, and he brings across this sense of England burning, because the imagery that comes up about the streets going afire as John realizes he's losing control of Julian. Mm-hmm. Just
yeah, well, I got that from the play, thanks to the great direction and mm-hmm. thanks to this fierce kids in the aisles. And you got a feeling that's what's out there. You're in this living room.
Hmm.
Where they meet once, where this former group of Pudlians meet once a year. But when these almost stormtrooper teenagers are in the aisles of the theater stamping, you know there's danger out there, and you see Julian on stage, and you get the sense. I was amazed that that play was never picked up for Broadway. It's that good. Hmm. It's that good. But I can well understand why it never made its way to Broadway, because I think the lawsuits, you know, over from Julian, from...
Yeah, I mean, it's Apple would have had their issues.
Apple Records.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, there's that other company.
No, that's true.
That said they would never get into music. They're the biggest purveyor of music in the world now. But the deal they made was that if they called their company Apple, they agreed with Apple Records, they would never get into music.
Whoops.
Yeah. Let's not get me started. I was pleased because it's on topic for what's forthcoming.
Yes.
But I was pleased to hold forth, and I don't think I've ever met anybody else who's ever heard of Liverpool Fantasy before. Mm-hmm. I didn't know it was a book. I met Larry Kerwin. No, I didn't meet him. I saw him perform Bloomsday Before Last, thanks to Simon Lokely, who was hosting an event outside the Ulysses Pub House, Ulysses Folk House and Pub for a big Bloomsday event on a gorgeous day. And Larry Kerwin gave quite the performance there, reading something from not Molly, some other woman having an orgasm in the middle of... And my God, Kerwin was... Well,
oh, yeah.
I think Black 47, that's his band.
Yes, that's his band.
I think they're actually due to be playing soon at B.B. King's.
Oh, that's right. They have a show coming up. And they also have a regular gig, I believe, at it's either Maggie Riley's. I think it's Maggie Riley's.
Yeah, I've never seen them.
Oh.
I've listened to them. They're great.
Oh, yes.
I've played them. I've never met Larry Kerwin. Mm. And I have to say that, I mean, take away even the Beatles stuff. This was genius in science fiction.
Mm.
This is proof that science fiction can make good theater. And I have no idea whether he was thinking in those terms or not. But he certainly accomplished it. Sometimes people aren't thinking genre.
True.
And here I go again. Mm. What have you got for us to read?
Well, we're sort of taking a long way about, but keeping within, in that we were talking about Rooftop Sessions. and alternate history in Beatles, it just so happens that I published a piece in the magazine back in 2002, which is particularly appropriate now in that this being the dual 50th anniversaries. On the one hand, you have the start of the Beatles as phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, it's about time, at about the same time that was happening, BBC had put aside half an hour on their Saturday afternoons for a program that is still with us.
That was on a broadcast first on November 23rd?
Yes.
That
program.
Yeah, okay.
And
which nobody heard of because November 22nd
yes.
was a horrific day in history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think this time, believe it or not, that the anniversary of the 23rd may get bigger newspaper play because the incident of the 22nd has been made into a movie, hundreds of books. It has been gone over and over and over, and people still debate the truth. There's no questioning the importance.
True.
But it's been discussed. Not that it's any the less important. But the 50th anniversary of the 23rd is going to be a worldwide broadcast event. In 3D, I understand. One can actually go to theaters and see it in 3D. I'm considering trying to figure out how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And assuming I'm on the air, the date closest to the 23rd beforehand, I'm going to get some of my Whovian friends, including Terrence Taylor, and I have asked Carol Pinchevsky, who was writing about Doctor Who for Forbes magazine.
Me, sir.
Oh,
can
yeah?
you throw me in?
yeah. Well, you may. I may try you out. Okay. Last week on the air, I announced that I have new partials, and I said new teeth. Barcelona.
Yes.
Okay. I asked anybody in the world to call up and explain that. Nobody did, but you got it just now.
Mm-hmm.
You are, and yeah. It's not minor trivia, for God's sake.
No, it isn't.
It's a regeneration.
Yes.
That's not trivial.
Oh, still not ginger.
Really?
Still.
Really? Although the next one, well, he's a squat. And he's so is Tennant. But Tennant did an English accent.
So that means in terms of Scott representation, the Doctor's now 2 for 3 between
yeah.
McCoy and... So he is actually... hopefully he will actually stand with the tartan.
Yeah, well, and he's not going to wear the kilt.
No, but I mean in terms of the accent.
But apparently he's going to do the accent, and Tennant quipped, "Oh well, that means he's just going to be lazy about it." I mean, you can barely understand a word David Tennant has to say when he's doing his.
What's that now?
I mean, you get David Tennant narrating a nature special, and he's able to turn the word earth into 3 syllables.
Earth.
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 Yes.
Yes.
Mm. And, of course, that those ads he did for labor, which was a little bit beyond just saying, "Don't you think she looks tired?"
Yes, which I really, really, really hate this very day. They should not have done that to Harriet.
Mm.
I think it was cruel and unnecessary and just...
Well...
No, that annoyed me. Well, that really annoyed the hell out of me. But let's not talk
yes.
about that right now.
Yes.
But no, you earned your way with the reference to Barcelona. You earned your way...
Oh, thank you.
Getting that.
Yes.
For all you listeners out there, shame, shame. Mm. I just opened the phone and said, anybody understands what that means when I said, new teeth? What was I talking about? Oh, yes, Barcelona, and nobody got it.
Oh, well.
And that's a biggie.
Well, you know, part of the problem is that everybody has noted how we're losing pieces of our heritage.
getting smaller on the inside.
Yes, so to speak.
As it were. Anyway.
Yes, yes. Where were we? I think we missed it.
Barcelona.
About three exits back there.
Yes, exactly. Yes. I'm sorry. I should call this digression radio.
No. That's quite all right. You think this is bad, you should see me right after I write. any event, we were talking about Altis and tie-ins, which is why this story is fairly appropriate for this. It's a piece that was done back in 2002 called Act Naturally. Richard Starr peeked through the curtains at the audience and straightened his tie. The crowd was not quite like the ones back in England, but there were a lot of similarities. The look in their eyes as they waited, he noted for one. The way they all wore different costumes for another. Among the Cybermen and the Ice Warriors, Richard counted at least 8 young men with seamen's coats and leather caps, a good sign that the crowd really was here for him. He looked over to the wings, where Adrian Hill was leaving the stage. He caught her eye and made a hand signal, as though lifting around. She tapped her wrist twice and pointed to the hotel's bar. Richard hoped he could remember how long a tap on the wrist was supposed to be. Some of the audience looked ready to storm the stage with pictures and programs and pens. Richard only now noticed the two young ladies who were wearing his old gear, looking very smart, dressed up as merchant sailors. Their faces were very well painted, their femininity bursting through their men's clothes the wore. He gave a smile despite himself, wondering just how much of his costume they wore underneath, and if they were fan enough to want to show him what was under their coats. The squawk of the microphone focused Richard intensely as the MC got his intros ready. And that was Adrian Hill, ladies and gentlemen, one of William Hartnell's more alluring companions, Katerina. Now, he said with a sudden wide-eyed facial stretch that threatened to spill over his glasses, there's a slight change to the program here at Fanticon. We decided to do away with the next guest and run nonstop episodes of Strike Force Omega. The howls of anger and groans at mention of a show that Richard had never heard of. So derisive a cry, he thought it would never play outside the American market, were met by the host with a gotcha smile. You'd think we'd really do that to you, the MC said, after we flew our next guest all the way out here to Chicago? Not many people may know this, but when Ringo said he'd grown up in a rough port and a lad, Richard could claim that too. A Liverpudlier. Liverpudlian, Richard called out from behind the curtain to correct him. At the sound of his voice, cheers began to come from the crowd. Ah, who am I kidding, said the MC. You don't really want me anyway. He used his hand to elicit a few awes from the crowd. So without further ado, the man who played Ringo Starr for 5 years and the ever-faithful companion throughout all of Patrick Troughton's time at the TARDIS controls, the incomparable Richard Starr! Richard smiled as he came out, giving a small wave to the crowd, as the enthusiastic standing ovation he got from them nearly bowled him over. He gave the MC a warm handshake, smiled for the crowd, and took one of the two chairs on stage while a Fanticon volunteer set up the midget mic stand for him as the host. Richard, said the host, thank you again for coming to the colonies for our celebration of the 15th anniversary of Doctor Who's premiere in England. Tell me, how do you find American fans?
Well, they usually come around and find me, said Richard. The first of them went for me Kit when I got off the plane, and it's been a mad dash from them ever since.
The crowd laughed at the joke. Richard felt a lot more at ease after that. So tell me, how did you, a lad from the north of England, end up traveling through time and space with the Doctor?
Well, it wasn't my first choice. I guess I was just lucky getting into acting and all.
Well, tell us, said the host, how'd that come about?
Believe it or not, I was originally going to be a musician. I'd spent me youth in a few bands from Liverpool as a drummer.
Richard paused as he let the murmur pass through the crowd.
I was in a couple of groups back then. Me first big break was with a band called the Hurricanes. We'd done a lot of gigs in the UK and Germany. Then I was asked to join this group called the Beatles. I was in there with three good friends, John Lennon, Paul McCartney, and George Harrison. We thought they were going to take on the world together.
Were you any good as a drummer? The host asked.
The crowd booed him for suggesting that their idol could have had a fault. I thought I did well, but they say we're our own worst critics, and I never did get a good chance to find out. We'd actually gotten a chance to record records in London, the four of us, but it just didn't happen.
Well, what went wrong?
Well, the man who was supposed to oversee our first record, it was a bit hard to get on with, and the four of us didn't care for him. He even gone so far as to have me replaced in a studio drummer for our first record. I wasn't too happy with him, and my bandmates Paul and John were also pissed with how he did things. The last day of the sessions, it got so tough that John lost it and put his fist into his face. And the poor man went through the glass wall they have in the recording studios. "Wow," said the host. Richard thought his rehearsed reaction looked real enough. So there we were, down to a trio, because EMI pressed charges against John. Our manager couldn't even get us into an HMV record store booth to record on our own after that. And for a few weeks, we had nothing. This was September of 62, and by the time John ended up with a few months and a heavy fine after this case in December, there was no group anymore. "So what made you go into acting then, if music wasn't in the cards?" "Well, I think I was especially shirty with the record producer, because me bird Maureen had flown." "A pet bird?" Richard remembered in time that the dumb question was part of the stage patter, and continued, "No, Maureen was me girlfriend. While I was on the road with the lads playing the drums, she'd met herself a bloke from Manchester. I was moody and mad at first for the longest, and that made that September so awful. But really, we had a trade in good... He had a trade in good O-levels, so I could see why he'd swept her off her feet. And by then there was Christmas."
"Christmas, eh?"
"Ah, Christmas," said Richard. "I'd stayed on in London, thinking I'd nothing to go back to, which was right. Me other bandmates, Paul and George, wrote postcards of how bad it was being ex-musicians now. But I wasn't doing much better in the city, odd jobs here and there. But on towards Christmas, I was feeling very hard on myself, so I said, 'Bugger it all, let's celebrate.' I went to a posh place in Kensington for a real good meal, and that's when I met Barbara."
"Barbara?"
the host asked conspiratorially. "She's a woman who I have to thank me stars for every night, because if things had just been a little different, I'd never have met her. She and I struck up a chat over and around. We ended up spending an hour together there. An hour turned into a night at her place." Richard paused as the innuendo called a few oohs from the audience. "Right. From there, night turned into a few months palling around the city, and then we'd been good friends on and off ever since. Wonderful woman she is, who introduced me to acting. Said I was a natural, though I didn't believe her, even if she was a casting agent."
"How could you doubt being an actor, Richard?"
"Well, for one," Richard pointed to his large nose, "you don't see a lot of matinee idols endowed with this now, do you? And I was a kid from the Dingle, the worst neighborhood of Liverpool, what we know of acting now.
But you did quite a bit starting in 63, didn't you?"
"Mostly small things then. I was one of the gamblers in the casino in Dr. No, for one. And when the Rolling Stones made the first movie, You Can Make It If You Try, I played one of the bobbies keeping the crowd in line as they ran from the train at Victoria Station. I was actually up for a role in Zorba the Greek, but I lost out when I couldn't do a good Greek accent. That's what led me to try a bunch of accents after that to keep me from losing roles."
"And what started you on to Doctor Who, right?"
"You've heard of us before, haven't you, son?" Richard smiled. "I was in the midst of doing a strong American accent refresher, trying to talk like John Wayne and all the time, which drove poor Barbara daft. She thought she'd kill me efforts by getting someone she'd heard was looking for actors to do Americans to turn me down, so she got me a reading for Verity Lambert, who was doing the story for Doctor Who called The Gunslingers, and to her great annoyance, I got cast as Johnny Ringo."
"That's how you got the name Ringo, right?"
"Oh, no, sir. I'd been a Ringo once before, as a drummer, because I used to wear lots of rings on me fingers. I had to sell most of them to stay in London back in 62, so the name fell away. But I was a convincing cowboy, and everyone called me Ringo after that as a joke."
"So how did Johnny Ringo become Ringo Stark, then?"
"Ah, we look ahead a few months, and Bill Hartnell wasn't fully himself anymore. When they considered what was going to happen next, figure out who'd do any of the action, they'd need him... They come up with the idea of a character who was a sailor. I think they wanted to call him Ben, and they even had a bloke lined up to do it. But then he backed out to do a long run on the West End. I hear now and then from Michael Craze, the man whose job I took, and we joke about how unfair life can be over a few rounds. Well," Richard continued, "suddenly they had to rethink things, and Verity remembered me from before and we talked about it. The character changed a bit when I got the role, because I had a lot of input on making him. He became a Liverpudlian, for one, and a bit more fun than they'd thought. They liked the name Ringo, so that's what the character's name became. And it was Stark because it sounds a little like the ship Cuddy Stark, and because it's a play on my real last name, Starkey."
"So when had you changed your last name?"
"Oh, I called myself Star since me music days, And when Barbara started suggesting how to present myself around, she suggested I use my real first name but keep Star. There you were, Ringo Stark and Polly Wright, caught up in the TARDIS after the War Machines. How long did you think you'd stay with the show? I always thought my first encounter with the Daleks I'd be gone, and the crowd laughed along with Richard's smile. I didn't expect to be there that long. As I said, Bill wasn't feeling too good, so I guessed along with everyone else he'd go, and the show would go with him. So when I read the script for The Tenth Planet, and then met Patrick for the first time, I felt really gear then. For us colonists, said the host, that means happy, right? A few of the colonists shouted rude things at the host for presuming their ignorance. I was never on the set after that. Patrick and I got on like a house of fire. We really hit it off. I was especially amazed at that, because here's me, this man who's only just fallen into his career, and a real professional who'd been at it for 20 years doing Shakespeare and all. We just couldn't stop being with each other. I think it was from day one, when he had a grab sneak some pudding into me pocket at the coat, so that when I'd do the scene, I'd find a mess in me hands. The way he laughed when I found the pudding, I knew it was him. And before day's end, I'd left a bucket of water over the sill of his dressing room door, so it'd be a long, long string of practical jokes between us and on everyone else the whole time. Through 4 seasons, 3 other companions, 3 meetings with the Daleks, 2 with the Cybermen, 3 with the Ice Warriors, what do you attribute to the fact that you're the only companion in the series' history to have been at the side of the Doctor throughout an entire regeneration? I think it was the fun we had, the way we'd get along. I could never bring myself to quit the show. And if Patrick ever said he'd want to go, I'd ask, and what of me, mate? So he'd stay on a little longer. It took the Beeb removing the show from the air in 70 to get us to stop coming to work. Otherwise, we'd both still be out there or out in some quarry somewhere, having more adventures in time and space. Richard, I'd like to take a few minutes for some of the fans' questions, if that's okay with you, the host asked. Love to, said Richard with a flourish. I've always got time for the fans. You kept me coming into work for 4 years, and you even brought back the Doc a year later, so how could I forget you? A young man in a T-shirt, with the face of the Third Doctor, John Levine, came up to a mic placed in the middle of the aisle and asked Richard, Are you sorry you never made it in music? Every day, Richard said with a solemn head nod before a wicked smile crept on his face. Of course, it's nice to think what would have happened had the Hurricanes or the Beatles had a chance to grab some of the glory that went to the Rolling Stones or the High Numbers. But I think my life turned out all right, Earl said. I wouldn't miss having Ben on the show all the time. A man dressed like William Hartnell's Doctor asked Richard, Will any of your later work come over to the States soon? Which show you mean now, Merchants of Venus? That and anything else, yeah. Well, the last I'd heard, there was some discussion as to whether Bob Heinlein, when he sold the rights to the Beeb, had actually given them the right to bring the show over to the States. It'd be a shame to miss it, in me humble opinion. There's not quite the same kinds of stories as Doctor Who, but we've got more money for spaceships and the like, so it looks just grand. By the way, said the host, we've heard that the adaptation of Great Expectations that BBC had done will be coming to PBS here this fall. Ah, said Richard, do catch it. You get a chance to see me do Wemmick. A young lady dressed in a futuristic-looking one-piece swimsuit, with her exposed skin painted gold, asked, Do you ever keep up with your friends in your old bands? Ah, said Richard. Let me tell you the one about the Beatles reunion. It happened in 1966, during the filming of the show The Horror of the Daleks. I invited the lads down to London for a fortnight to catch up on old times. As it happened, Patrick and I had made few of the crew in the shop wary of ever driving those pepper pots near us. Something about blowing itching powder under the hoods, I guess. So we needed 3 Dalek drivers, and I suggested I knew 3 good fellows who could sit on a tricycle in a cramped space and were willing to do it for scale. And to my surprise, they agreed. Now, George and Paul had no trouble at all with it, but John hadn't told anyone. Sorry, technical issue. But John, he hadn't told anyone that he needed glasses more than he had the last I'd seen him. So you can see the 4 of us on screen together for a few scenes when the Daleks corner me and Victoria a few times. But you have to look quick, because John couldn't see out that thing and kept missing his mark all the time. He's the Dalek that keeps veering away in every scene. So, the young lady asked a follow-up, what happened to them? Well, we all know about George, how he got together with Jerry Marsden and formed their band, before he met up with Eric Clapton and Robert Plant to form Indalo. Paul went on to become a painter and poet, mostly doing things in the West End. John's had his ups and downs, but these days he's level, said Richard. hoping he wouldn't have to elaborate. Thankfully, another person dressed as the Fourth Doctor, but without Paul Darrow's icy charm, had a turn at the other mic and asked, of the three companions who shared the TARDIS with you, Polly, Victoria, and Zoe, which was your favorite? Ah, said Richard, looking up to think. Well, Annika Willis was a daring woman who left us a little too soon. Deborah Watling was a decent lady who put up with quite a few shenanigans from Patrick and me, taking it like a pro. Now, Wendy Padbury, she could dish it out, especially one of them. Richard, interrupted the host. I think he meant your characters. Ah, right. Sorry there. Richard noticed a look on the fan's face finally. Well, I liked them all. I noticed as we got a new female companion, new one was smarter than the one before her, and the way Zoe could add an oar, we'd have been hard-pressed to find a smarter woman. I think they were all good characters. It would be interesting if we could get all five of us in one adventure sometime. I remember when we did the 10th anniversary show. I was there with Patrick and John, and I was the only companion they invited back. Took a lot of scratch, son, to make you watchy! Someone screamed into Richard's ear. Richard jumped from the chair and spun around, his shock deepening when he beheld the long face before him. Whoa, said the host. Ladies and gentlemen, an unscheduled appearance this afternoon by none other than Patrick Troughton. The room was on its feet, and Richard hugged his old friend before the crowd. Cole, didn't expect to see you about till later, said Richard. Tag, said Peter. Patrick, with a gleam in his eye. Richard smiled and waved to the crowd, with his arm around the Second Doctor, plotting how he was going to get back at him then.
They're gonna put me in the movies. They're gonna make a big start out of me. They make a film about a man that's sad and lonely. And all I gotta do is act naturally.
Well, that was annoying. The computer just sort of crapped out on us. But I hope you all enjoyed that music from Doctor Who at the end there. you know, it's not like having Matt Smith and Karen Gillan singing. Definitely off-key this morning. But as it is, I mean, it's... on the other hand, we only have about 3 minutes left.
Oh.
Given outro music and all that.
Wow.
Yeah. No, time flies.
Especially when we're having fun.
Yeah, this is great. Exactly. Well,
I have to thank you for having me on.
We'll make it a return visit because we had to burn half an hour at the beginning, and then I was, you know, waxing with whatever wax was melting nearby and all that. But the name of your website, as opposed to the one for your novel...
Well, actually... Where Raging Gale is also the resident of my blog, which goes under the name Going on the Account.
Okay.
The name chosen because that was a term that most pirates would use in order to explain their going out on ventures.
Ah, okay.
I had also finished Jim was talking about the other novel that I had done, which is at a different site that ties into it, called Red Jenny and the Pirates of Buffalo.
Right.
Yes, there is a theme going on here. It's a...
You got Melissa Beckman from Buffalo all excited when you mentioned that at your reading.
I mean, the way her eyes lit up whenever I mentioned shared geography there. But, yeah, that's...
Buffalo fandom.
Yes.
Won't you come out tonight?
Mm-hmm. But it was interesting because I was always trying to find my best to describe the book, and with 12 chapters left to print, then suddenly somebody coined the term cli-fi. So I'm happy to say I had a book that was there before the genre was determined. I don't want to take claim for it because I'm sure there are better books than mine out there that can take that.
But spell Jenny and all that for us so that people know.
That's REDJENNY www.wordpress.com.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm a cheap so-and-so.
Well, whatever. I mean, hey, that's fine. You know,
and that's also being shared right now, as is Raging Gale.
Okay, and Raging Gale is spelled...
R-A-G-I-N-G-G-A-I-L.
G-A-I-L, because if it were like as in a storm, not as in Gale Storm, but like, you know, a gale, mm-hmm. G-A-E-L would be the gale.
I thought it was L-E. G-A-L-E?
No, that would be Dorothy Gale.
Mm.
But I think there's multiple spellings.
Somewhere
of Gale, so
over thesaurus.
Indeed, indeed. Well, 20 seconds left, and I haven't even queued up the outro, which I ought to do. And we can actually talk over it a little bit, but we also have to mention that Burn Baby Burn Clapper is coming your way.
Yay.
In but a few seconds, starring Lister, no relationship. Or vague relationship, maybe, to Red Dwarf. There's a relation to Craig Charles there, wouldn't you say? Is that
a little bit of one?
Isn't that his name, Craig Charles?
Yeah.
And
without my H to port on my forehead here.
You're Holly. Yes. You're Hollyhock, as it were. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, God knows I'm not dressed not well enough to be Cat, so.
Yeah, there's that. Although, again, Lister, you could play Cat if you really wanted. Have you ever thought of it? And he features in my favorite episode of that entire series is the one where Cat is involved in their being multiple versions of them.
Oh,
in
yes,
time.
The opposite of Cat.
Yeah, it's one of the early.
Right, he gets he plays opposite. He thinks his opposite number is going to be a female cat, but it's actually a male dog.
There's that.
And he looks like somebody out of Central Casting. It could have easily been somewhere near Louisville.
Yeah, so. or Central Catting, as the case may be.
Yes.
But we have to say good morning. Well, assuming that there will be an again, we'll have to do this again.
I would certainly love to.
Yeah, and I'm still thinking of, you know, arranging a Nyrsif kind of thing, a proper one where you're scheduled in advance.
Where I could actually call a couple of people to show up. Hey,
yeah.
That might be nice.
Yeah, it would be, but we still have to thank Keith for not having shown up. He made up for that later, by the way, by coming up here on a moment's notice. But again, Jim Ryan, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me, Jim.
And I want to thank Susan and friends for live blogging the show on Facebook. That was different.
She's going to be very tired in the morning.
Yeah, well, join in. I have to do this every week.
Ooh, yes.
So thank you again. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I will be back in theory. Actually, I'll be on from 6 to 8 a.m. this Saturday, if they stick to that schedule, which is an unknown without a program director at this point. At least he's not in New York anymore. So who knows what happens to WBAI in the hearts and minds of Fenn. It's confusing.
So like a good Doctor Who serial, it's a continuing story with a cliffhanger.
Yes. Well, let's hope that WBAI can regenerate. So thank you all for listening. Stay tuned. Oh, my God. It's 45 seconds left. So Steel Eye Span, we go out again. Jim sure. Ryan, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. Oh, yeah. Do check out Hour of the Wolf on Facebook and OurWolf.com online.
My lips, I am a revolutionary, and you're gonna have to. keep on saying that. You're gonna have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the red, white, and blue spit on you.
Myself, torturing the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right, and it's right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. And drag it and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
The flag, I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. fun.
Yeah. 99 Cinco Lista Live, 5 minutes after 3 o'clock. 5 minutes after 3 o'clock, 99 Cinco, WBAI. Flag burning time, 5 minutes after 3 o'clock. We do this right up until background briefings right here at 99 Cinco, WBAI. 212-650-5782. The great Michael Rose right here, dedicating this to the man called Terry Wilson. One of the greatest reggae artists on the face of the earth. Listen to this. Here it is. List Alive, 99 Sync, 10 minutes after the hour, 10 minutes after 3 o'clock, you know, playing all the reggae music they refuse to play in imperialist America. Earn Baby Bird.
I want you to know me inside out, outside inside. I want you, I want you, baby. Know me like you know yourself. I want you.